The title of this book is Antechinus, Poems 1975 to 1980. It was written by A.D. Hope and narrated by Brian Harrison.
About this Daisy book. This Daisy book has been produced by converting an existing analog recording. It may contain references to and artifacts of the original tape recording. This book may be structured using two levels. Level 1 containing each main heading, and level 2 each subheading. This converted recording may contain page numbers that do not match the original print version. If it does not contain page numbers, you can still navigate by using all other features of your Daisy player. Book information.
This edition was published by Angus and Robertson Publishers of North Ryde, New South Wales, in 1981. ISBN 0207-14481-8. This recording has been made in the audio production unit of the Royal Blind Society, Enfield, New South Wales, in 1989. It consists of a dedication, preface, the book divided into the following four parts. Part 1, The Drifting Continent, contains Beyond Cancoban, The Nomads, Hills, Country Places. Three songs for Monero Pubs. Full as a boot, no kidding, she'll be Jake. Hay Fever, Tasmanian Magpies. In Memoriam, James Philip Macaulay, 1976. Antechinus, The Drifting Continent. Part 2, Poems from Pausanias, contains the poems Beyond Phigalia, Niobe, Canathos, A Fountain Near Thalamae, The 13th Labour, Shepherds at Delphi, The Wild Bees, and Archilochus. Part 3, The People of the Pale, contains Friday's Child, The Waters, Riposta Jaques, The Alpha Omega Song, The Hills, Beware of Ruins, The People of the Pale, Creation, Jupiter on Juno, Inscription for a War, Four Epigrams, Romancero, Anniversary Ode 1577 to 1977, Obad, The Legend of the Myrrh Tree, Salabanjika, Making Love, The Cetaceans, and In Memoriam, Ian Maxwell, 1979. Part 4, Homage to Anna Akhmatova, contains the poems Letter to Amanda, a translation of Secrets of the Craft, including the sections Creation, Last Poem, There Is Much Probably That Still Desires. A translation of the poems Voronish, Lot's Wife, The Muse, Leningrad in March 1941, and In Memory of My Neighbor. A Northern Elegy for a Grave at Komarovo, and notes. From the back cover of the book jacket. At ease with both the long poem and the short lyric, with both the profoundly tragic and the sardonic or satirical, A.D. Hope has long been recognized as one of the most outstanding poets in the history of Australian literature, with a range and command unsurpassed by any other poet. His new volume is remarkable for its variety, inventiveness, and unfailing skill and virtuosity. Divided into four main groups of poems, it ranges with breathtaking assurance from a series of dialogues with the spirits of Banjo Paterson and the great Russian poet Anna Akhmatova, from variations on themes from Pausanias to reflections on the past and future of Western civilization, drawing its imagery from the realms of ancient learning, myth and symbolism, as well as from modern science. Some of the poems in this book, like the Elegy to James Macaulay, the allegorical The People of the Pale, and Salabanjika, show Hope writing with a force and passion unequalled elsewhere in his work. These belong already to the classics of modern Australian poetry. Antichinus, Poems 1975 to 1980, for Penelope. Preface. This volume abandons my practice in the earlier ones of arranging the poems by years in which they were composed. The reason for this is that three of the four sections of the book consist of poems composed at various times, but meant to go together. The Drifting Continent reproduces the text of a privately printed edition of poems with an Australian reference, issued in 1979 by the Brindabella Press, with illustrations by Arthur Boyd. I am grateful to Alec Bolton, who produced the limited edition, for permission to reprint the text for a wider range of readers. I am also grateful to Mr. Frank Knight for permission to use his delightful picture of Antichinus Stuartii, who gives his name to the collection as a whole. Poems from Pausanias represents my part in a Sunday evening radio program, planned, written, and performed jointly with Rosemary Dobson and recorded by the Australian Broadcasting Commission in 1977, and to whom my acknowledgements are due. Homage to Anna Akhmatova consists of poems and translations made over a number of years and recently published in the magazine Helix, 1980, to whose editor I also make acknowledgement. I should like to thank Mrs. Amanda Haidt and Mrs. Ursula Schwalbach for reading the text and for criticism of the Russian translations. The People of the Pale gathers together a selection of poems not related in any way, composed for the most part between 1975 and 1980. For the whole book, I would like to make acknowledgement to the following anthologies and journals in which a number of the poems were first published. Canberra Poetry, Quadrant, The Pauline, Poet's Choice, Poems in Honour of James Macaulay, Albion Press, Overland, Blacksmith, Southerly, Westerly, Iceland and the Medieval World, The Bulletin, 100th Anniversary Issue, Helix, Waroni, Hemisphere. I would also like to thank Peter Levy for permission to quote from his translation of Pausanias in my notes, and Mrs. Jane Prowse for permission to use the original of the Antichinus picture in her possession. Acknowledgements are also due to Angus and Robertson for permission to reprint poems from earlier volumes. The Drifting Continent, for Alec Bolton. Beyond Kankoban. Beyond Kankoban, the road winds into hills that lead to the Hymenaero of my birth. I emerge from a pass to a vast blue valley which fills my mind with those august presences of earth, austere in their stillness, great mountains that watch and abide, where trees stand tier above tier in the tranquil air, crown that great theatre, pack it from side to side, feasted with music, of which I am not aware. A sky full of light pours down its viewless rain on a landscape lost in its thoughts, as I in mine. Places and names that echo and remain. Kankoban, Kosciuszko, Tom Grogan, Ginderbine signal my way as I drive through the afternoon, a silent pilgrim fulfilling an ancient vow. The road winds, rises, and veers like a difficult tune, known always, but mastered for the first time now. For the heart of this utter solitude has been tapped. As I move on, the brooding landscape comes alive. Now I catch the music that holds this audience rapt. I am turning its world into music as I drive. The car winding on becomes a center of this perpetual wheeling of trees in their solemn dance. Just as Earth seems at night to spin the galaxies, an illusory motion to our illusory stance. Yet not a total illusion when all is said. Though it does not happen out there, but in the mind, the music itself is real. We are not misled, but have glimpsed a mysterious function of mankind. We have sampled a fragment of that mystery by which the inanimate wakes to life and thought, and the universe shakes itself free from entropy, in whose dull net all frames of matter seem caught. In our minds is it able to enter the dance. Moved by our music, things learn themselves and rejoice. I would count it worthwhile to spend life for this single glance, to have made them conscious in me, to have lent them my voice. Now the blue gums crowd in close to a tunnel of shade. The car labours up to the pass. I think of the spot to which I return, from which long ago I was made, Cooma, and wonder whether it made me or not. Man is made by all that has made the history of man, but here the Monero claims me. I recognise beyond Cancoban the place where a mind began able to offer itself to the galaxies. The Nomads. Men in cities, men busy everywhere, live by a faith that roads lead to some end. Home. Pleasure. A goal attained. A lover. A friend. If it were not so, they say, we must despair. But not the nomads. They never think this way. Wherever they chance to stop, the roads go on to nowhere, to anywhere. For them, the one despair is a fixed roof, a permanent stay. Theirs are different natures. They see the things we see. The words are the same. They look with different eyes. I would not call them more human or less wise, nor think them less happy, more justified than we. They are simply other. They give and they forgive, but do not ask for anything in return. Learn only what they have no need to unlearn. Clutch at no rights, claim no prerogative. When I ask my friend the nomad, would you agree I have made my mark in the world? He answers, why, yes, you have made something of your life, but I prefer to find out what life will make of me. I speak of love. He laughs, saying, friend, you have won that treasure to hold and keep. But love for me is a wayward lightning, a chance felicity, an unguessed gateway opening on the unknown. I talk of his life. The endless, empty miles, the trivial monotony of the wanderer's way. He asks, have I lived by the joy of the single day? I talk then of death, but he looks at me and smiles, saying, ah, but you live so rooted in time, you see. You have never experienced an absolute moment, my friend. Death is not the beginning of anything, nor the end. But as each instant lived for itself must be, that pure, that limitless now, eternity. Hills. Says Tumbledown Dick to Pretty Sally, why are you so very far away? Were we divided by just one valley, we could roll together and we could play. Says Pretty Sally to Tumbledown Dick, that is just the trouble with being a hill. Though lying nearer might do the trick, the valley would fall between us still. And if, by the force of hugging and heaving, we should make the bed of that valley our own, we could get no good of this longing and grieving, for each of us harbours a heart of stone. Country places. Hell, Hay, and Boolagol. I glean them from signposts in these country places. Weird names, some beautiful, more that make me laugh. Driving to Fat Lamb sales or to picnic races, I pass their worshippers of the golden calf, and in the dust of their Cadillacs, a latter-day Habakkuk rises in me to preach comic sermons of doom, crying, woe unto Tokumwal, Teddy Waddy Tulibuck, and wicked Wallumburrawong, your hour has come! But when the four horsemen ride their final muster, and my sinful country sinks in the fiery rain, one name shall survive the doom and the disaster that fell on the foolish cities of the plain. Like the three holy children or the salamander, one place shall sing and flourish in the fire. It is Sweet Water Creek at Mullingandra, and there at the last day I shall retire. When Numbugger shrieks to Burrumbuttock, the curse of Sodom comes upon us all. When Tumbarumba calls for spade and mattock, and they bury hell and hay in Booligal. When the wrath of God is loosed upon Gilgandra, and Gulagambone burns red against the west. To Sweet Water Creek at Mullingandra, I shall rise and flee away and be at rest. When from Goonoo Goondoo, Underbool and Grong Grong and Suggenbuggen there goes up the cry, from Tittybong, Drick Drick and Drung Drung, help, Lord, help us, so we die. I shall lie beside a willow cool meander, or cut myself a fly whisk in the shade, and from Sweetwater Creek at Mullingandra, fill my cup and wet my whistle unafraid. When Boinka lies in ruins, more's the pity, and a heavenly trump proclaims the end of grace, with Wombat is fallen that great city, adding Bunyip is in little better case. When from Puckapunyal and from Yakadanda the cry goes up, how long, O Lord, how long? I shall hear the she-oak sow at Mullingandra, and the sweet waters ripple into song. Oh, there's little to be hoped for Grabungullin, and Tumbulgan shrinks and shudders at its fate. Folks at Wantabadgeree and Cullenbullen have Buckley's chance of reaching heaven's gate. It's all up with Cootamundra and Kyandra, and at Collarenabri they know they're through. But at Sweetwater Creek at Mullingandra you may pitch your camp and sleep the whole night through. God shall punish Carjellico, come by chance Chingapook. They shall dance no more at Merrijig, nor drink at Gentleman's Halt. The sin of Moombuldoo he shall in no wise overlook. We Jasper and little Jillaby, he shall not condone their fault. But though I preach down Nap-Nap and annihilate Narandra, one place shall yet be saved, this I declare. Sweetwater Creek at Mullingandra, for its name, and for my sake, the Lord shall spare. Coda. Alas, my beautiful, my prosperous, my careless country. She destroys herself. The Lord will come too late. They have cut down even their only tree at one tree. Dust has choked Honey Bugle and drifts over Creeper Gate. The fires we lit ourselves on Mount Boothgandra have made more ruin than heaven's consuming flame. Even Sweetwater Creek at Mullingandra, if I went there now, would it live up to its name? Three songs for Monero pubs. Full as a boot.
Full as a boat, lad, full as a boat. Well, cross, why shouldn't I be? When that barm ain't there, she's a piece of fruit. Mike and rum and clothes for me. Full as a boat. But when I was young, they christened me Never Tired Jack. Rum and clothes, and you'd never go wrong to lay that piece on her back. Down with her bottom, up with her heels. Tackle her tit for tat. Never you mind if she bucks or squeals. All the better for that. Never you mind, that's my advice. Give her one on the floor. Rum and clothes to her, sugar and spice. She'll tear you apart for more. I'm sure at the Rock, I've roused at Condoblin. I've rabbited up round parks. And wherever I camped, them girls come nosing, nosing around like sharks.
It was, no, Jack, no, I promised me mother, or, geez, you're a bastard, Jack.
But have it your own way, have it the other, she'd end up flat in the back. One girl I left her in Jerrington, one up by Cape of Sea. But that little honey at Cup of Cumberlong, she up and she left me. Oh, she up and she left me there, horn mad. She up and left me flat. The best bloody woman that ever I had. To do a thing like that.
No kidding. Back at the pub in Nimitabelle, back from a spell out west, who shall I meet but my sweetheart Nell, giving her babe the breast? So there you are, my Randy Jack. So it's you, my no-good honey. Where have you been? And now you're back, say, what do you use for money?
Oh, I've gone straight this whole long year, up north in Narrabri. Without a word of a lie, my dear. Without a word of a lie. But where did he come from, this little nip? Say, where did you find young Blossom?
Oh, I got him out of a lucky dip while you was playing possum. He came to me straight from heaven above. He came from the bright blue sky. Without a word of a lie, my love. Without a word of a lie.
She'll be Jake.
Jesus, what's got in a jock? When I asks him how his tricks bloody nearly done his block, comes down like a load of bricks. What? That piece from you, campaign? No, for Christ's sake. Chucked him, has she? Well, I mean, she'll be Jake. Girls, they always back and fill, saying no and meaning yes. Christ, have I been through the mill. Might have married one, I guess. Yeah, I could have too, by God. But for Christ's sake, just end with this poor sod. She'll be Jake. Ah, there, Jocko. I just heard. Shot through, did she? Lucky yous. Get yourself another bird. That's a shot, mate. What's the use crying in your bloody beer? Well, for Christ's sake, she'll be Jake, mate. Never fear. She'll be Jake.
Hay fever. Time, with his scythe honed fine, takes a pace forward. Swings from the hips. The flesh crumples and falls in windrows, curving away. Waiting my turn as he swings. Not yet, not mine. I recall the sound of the scythe on an earlier day. Late spring in my boyhood, learning to mow with the men. 8 of us mowing together in echelon line, out of the loosened patch and into the hay, and I at the end on the left because I was fresh, because I was new to the game and young at the skill. As though I were time himself, I remember it still. The mild Tasmanian summer. The men are here to mow for my minister father and make his hay. They have brought a scythe for me. I hold it with pride. The loosen is up to my knee, the grass to my waist. I set the blade into the grass as they taught me the way. The still dewy stalks nod, tremble and tilt aside. Cornflowers, loosen and poppies, sugar grass, summer grass, laced with red-stemmed dock. I feel the thin steel crunch through hollow-stalk milk thistle, self-sown oats and rye. I snag on a fat hen clump. Chickweed falls in a bunch, but sorrel scatters. Dandelion casts up a golden eye to a smell of cows chewing their cuds, the sweet hay breath. The boy with the scythe never thinks it the smell of death. The boy with the scythe takes a stride forward, swings from the hips, keeping place and pace, keeping time by the sound of the scythes, by the swish and ripple, the sigh of the dying grass like an animal breathing, a rhyme falling pat on the ear that matches the steel as it sings true through the tottering stems. Sweat runs into my eye. How long to a break? How long can I hold out yet? I nerve my arms to go on. I am running with, flooding with sweat. How long ago was it? Why, The scythe is as obsolete now as arrows and bow. I have lived from one age to another, and I have made hay while I could, and the sun still shone. Time drives a harvester now. He does not depend on the weather. Well, I have rolled in his hay in my day, and now it is gone. But I still have a barn stacked high with that good dry mow. Shriveled and fragrant stems, the grass and the flowers together, and a thistle or two in the pile for the prick of remorse. It is good for a man when he comes to the end of his course, in the barn of his brain, to be able to romp like a boy in the heap, to lie still in well-cured hay, to drift into sleep. Tasmanian magpies. Ethiopia, they used to say, fluting at dawn through pure, clear rills of sound, the magpies of that earlier day. Ethiopia, Ethiopia, from all around. Dulcimer of no Abyssinian maid was ever so plangent, or so doucely played. Ethiopia, Ethiopia. Echoes went through me of Mount Abora. Another country, another age. I still hear them at early morning in the trees. The same pure grace notes, the same exquisite trill, the lilt, the liquid ease, but not the enchantment of that warbled name. The magpie dialect here is not the same. The magic syllables have gone that brought me full awake and roused the sun. Lost Ethiopia. Is that loss in me? Monero magpies bursting into song soar through new cadences, fresh jubilee, but in an unknown tongue rejoice. Can it perhaps be true that I have lost those languages I knew in boyhood, when each bird, stone, cloud, and every tree that grew spoke, and I had by heart all that I heard? In Memoriam, James Philip Macaulay, 1976. Sleep sound here, brother, by your tranquil bay. What can the tongue we both served now express other than this? All that is left to say is loss and emptiness. Empty as ocean stretches towards the pole beyond this island which you loved, my friend. This island where at last you reached your goal of landfall at Land's End. This island, which your lucid poet's eye made living verse, wildflower and sedge and tree and creatures of its bushland, beach and sky, took root in poetry, until a world to which your poet's mouth gave being and utterance, country of the heart, land of the Holy Spirit in the south, became its counterpart. It was my island, too, my boyhood's home, my land of similes. From all you gave, this I hold close and cherish as I come to your untimely grave. Where the great mount's apocalyptic beast now guards your bones and watches from the height, fixing his lion gaze towards the east for the return of light, standing on this last promontory of time, I match our spirits, the laggard and the swift, though we shared much beside the gift of rhyme, yours was a surer gift. Your lamp trimmed, full of oil, you went before, early to taste the bridegroom's feast of song. Wait for me, friend, till I too reach that door. I shall not keep you long. Antechinus. Antechinus, my hero, small furred friend, I come to bury, not praise you in your house, the sclerophyll forest. Yet if I commend your brief fierce life, intrepid marsupial mouse, it is that your image, mirrored in my mind, strangely reflects features of my own kind. First to rehearse your scarcely credible tale. Born in September, reared 2 months in the pouch, you live life as a solitary male. By day, in hollow trees or logs you crouch. By night, hunt worms and insects in the dew, while owl and snake and native cat hunt you. And if you should survive till next July, the time is ripe for you to find a mate. Then, knowing that having mated you will die, your small wild heart grows grim with rage and hate to hunt and savage all members of your race, even the female clutched in your embrace. That copulation, charged with love and death, may last 10 hours, and even more, they say. And though it trips the trap that stops your breath, does that supreme delirium repay the solitude, the darkness, the blind strife of this short savage irony, your life? An irony no species quite escapes, for love and death too rule the human dream. Lives of all mammals, like their bodily shapes, are simply variations on one theme, whose patterns ring changes on a paradox common to all our biological clocks. Though a faint echo of your starker tale, some of us live to a full century, with us the female too outlives the male, but for no purpose now that I can see. When summoned by death's peremptory call, mere span of life means nothing much at all. Guided by nature's all-adapting voice, man managed a variation more benign. I am not faced with your heroic choice of love entailing death, nor you with mine of love repeated to fritter itself away in change and failure, or final sad decay. If only the author of Leviathan had known your case, for sure he would have thought yours a parable of his life of primitive man. Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. He would have laughed to see confirmed in you his paradigm justified, his fable true. And yet who knows? Old Tom, who never wed, used women little, could not abide a wife, singing prick song in his solitary bed, which exercise he thought prolonged his life, at last, at 90, being by love possessed, might well have envied your consummatum est. And so do I, and wonder if the course of evolution had reversed our roles, how would I cope with that compulsive force in time's black frost, when to her fire of coals our naked Venus beckoned with her full breasts and bold thighs, and on her neck a skull. Would cowards by then have bred out with no trace? Would love with us by now have grown a deed dared gladly for continuance of the race, as bearers of that sole immortal seed through which, if my own species has forgot, the river of life still runs, though yours has not? And might we not, in recompense, have known the crown of love compelled to the one choice, sole passion, sole fulfilment, all one's own, and heard the solitary poet's voice proclaiming, pure beyond comparison, the absolute, full, and final ecstasy. And to kindness, my friend, almost forgot in such reflections, let us reflect again. Since life presents each absolutely, and not as rival species from amoebas to men, which has achieved the best that life can give? We do not know. We accept our lot and live. Author's note. Note 1, from the ANU Reporter, 24th of November, 1972. Antechinus tuatii, a marsupial, about the size of a mouse, lives in the sclerophyll forest and evidently makes solitary nests in undergrowth. It also climbs trees. Antechinus is a predator and lives on insects and earthworms. It is a quick-moving, mostly nocturnal animal. The female gives birth in September, and the males live for less than 1 year. In June and July, they become intolerant of other members of their species. In the ACT, they mate during the second half of August, and the only males that remain after that are embryos in utero. Whereas rodents copulate frequently for a few seconds at a time, And echinus males may take about 5 hours over a single act of coitus. Note 2. From A Guide to the Native Mammals of Australia by W. D. L. Ride, Melbourne, Oxford University Press, 1970, page 118. Mating in the brown ant echinus is a violent procedure. The powerful males seize the females by the scruff of the neck and maneuver them into position. Basil Marlowe has described how non-receptive females, unable to escape in captivity from the savage and violent males, are badly lacerated about the head and neck in attempted courtship. They even die from their injuries. Copulation is very prolonged, lasting more than 5 hours and sometimes up to 12 hours. Note 3. From Mammals of the World by E. L. Walker, Baltimore, John Hopkins Press, 1964, Volume 1, page 28. Antechinus take shelter in hollow trees, fallen logs, rock crevices, abandoned nests of birds along cliffs and caves. They are preyed upon by owls, snakes, and large decelurides, native cats, and domestic cats. End of author's note. The Drifting Continent. Black Mountain. Summer. All those years ago. So no further back than, say, last week, that meeting of mammal with monotreme comes to mind. The mountain above us, the parched plain below, we sat in the dry gully of a dry creek. I picnicking with a female of my kind. Two recent mammals, perhaps the last of all. The strangest and most generalized, at least, we shared our sandwich lunch, poured out our wine. The air was shrill with locusts, I recall. Ants and the pestering bush flies joined our feast. She sat and held her hairless paw in mine. The ancient land enfolded us. Our talk turned to its arid earth, the history of its archaic inhabitants adrift on its Precambrian shield and later rock, of their long isolation on the sea, progressing by that imperceptible shift, 2 centimetres a year or so, they say, mounted upon the great tectonic plate on which it floats upon the mantle below. And of ourselves, frail creatures of a day, yet the sole animal to contemplate the irony of its own fierce urge to know. What other mammal recalls its past, I said, but man, and can remember all others too? She laughed and said, the geophysical year made possible that dialogue with the dead. As for our place upon this drifting zoo, remember we are interlopers here. Placental mammals on marsupial ground. We are trespassers on their continental raft, inching its way up from the pole, said she. But though no fossil record has been found, there was an older crew aboard this craft before those first marsupials put to sea. Before it set out from Gondwana land, perhaps 200 million years ago, the earliest of mammals, or the last of links with bird and reptile, held command. And this was monotreme country then, although they vanished, leaving no trace upon the past. But 2 of them survive, the only 2 to help us guess what once they must have been. 1 is the duck-billed platypus, and 1 the spiny anteater. As if on cue, as she broke off, far down the dry ravine a creature moved from shadow into sun, and at its shuffling pace the echidna came towards us from the immemorial past. We watched and held ourselves as still as death, pausing to lick up ants and such more game. Here comes a member of your crew at last, I muttered to my friend below my breath. She did not speak or nod, but watched it quest slowly along the dry creek's sandy bed. It seemed to waddle upon its powerful claws, here lifting a stone, scouring a meat ant's nest, turning from side to side its bird-like head. Yet though it seemed so often to loiter and pause, it shambled level with us before we knew. Halted, and peered about with purblind eyes, and seemed to sense, although it could not see, the creatures on the bank. It sniffed my shoe and snuffled. We saw the momentary rise of quills along its back. Then, quietly, out of the pipe-like mouth, a worm of tongue flickered and tasted all along the welt. And as though puzzled, it stood there deep in thought, till, having considered, it went its way along the creek and round a bend. It must have felt a tremor through the subsoil of some sort, or heard me as I leapt to follow, for fast as I turned the corner it was gone. And yet how could it? The ravine ahead was bare and clear for 15 yards or more. I looked for hollow burrow. There was none. Then my companion, following, laughed and said, "Try looking by your feet." And when I did, the sandy floor before me was astir with points of spines. Echidna had dug in so fast that in 5 seconds it was hid. "Best leave him to himself," I said to her. "At least we have seen the race of mammals begin." She answered, "But it could have been a dream. We are too ephemeral to comprehend such motion as your continental drift. Perhaps this meeting for the monotreme was no beginning, but presaged the end. Man's landing on their raft was dire and swift. How many of its old crew have vanished, say, as this one in the sand before your feet? How many species since 1788, when we first came aboard this transport, may already count their massacre complete, outside the central desert at any rate?" "Man looks before and after," I replied. "I wonder where this curious ark is bound, and who of all its internecine crew will man it when, borne on the magmal tide, on a more massive raft it runs aground, as Sister India is said to do. My bet's on the Echidna, before man. Man is too greedy to survive for long, needs far too many gadgets to succeed. Echidna needs no more than ants, and can get by with no technology but its tongue. When man has perished with all that served his greed, I see our drifting continent arrive, Echidna and the ants alone on board. Some of man's ruins, perhaps, for what they're worth. Or if he wins, perhaps no creature alive may make that landfall, when not fire and sword, but effluence and his filth have killed the earth. Should life renew itself in time to come, some new intelligence may find it moored against a young uplifted mountain crest, or still adrift, and wonder at the doom that overtook its crew, like those aboard that sea enigma, the Mary Celeste. Mary of Heaven, great Mammary Mama, star of the sea to whom all mammals pray, will she protect us yet?" I asked. We laughed, questioning should we invoke an older star, a more archaic saint who, in their day, blessed monotremes and piloted their craft. We laughed, but with a deep and growing unease. We had lost our human assurance of thought and speech. The elemental silence deprived our breath. Lost in the tale of all those centuries, we were no longer persons, each to each, but ciphers in a species bound for death. Poems from Pausanias for Rosemary Dobson. Beyond Figalia. She was a woman obsessed by an old book. Even its footnotes were occasions of song. One day she sent to the oracle, saying, "Look into my case. Tell me if I do wrong. Should I divorce Pausanias because he is enchanted ground? Because I fear I may never return to be the woman I was, holding an old stone by a spring more dear?" The oracle answered, "It is already too late. Go on, go forward. It is all you can do. She will greet you at nightfall by a ruined gate, the woman who waited all these years to be you. Niobe. Where have you been, boy? Why are you so pale? Ranging the mountain, mother, for sights to see. Tantalus' tomb, the city beneath the lake. And at noon, following a doubtful trail, the heat, the silence must have worsted me. For as I paused, wondering which way to take, burst from the crags above beyond belief, wild lamentation and unearthly grief. What could that be, say, in such solitudes? What but the grief of Niobe, my boy, weeping for her irreparable loss? Remember your Homer. Among the nymphs she broods, so great Achilles said to Priam of Troy, over her sorrows on Mount Sipylos, hearing still those fatal arrows slap and hiss from shining Apollo and fierce Artemis. There, turned to everlasting stone, they say, she sits. And while the tears course down her cheeks, each summer her mother's cry enchants the place. But I saw no one, mother. Another day go back. Where that path twisting to the peak stops, you can stand and see her face to face. And gazing on those ruined features, you may grasp a grief that time cannot undo. And so the boy Pausanias went back 10,000 years in eagerness and dread to find the Niobe of that folk-tale dream. It was a disappointment. Where the track ended, he saw her. As he later said, only a rock washed by a mountain stream, one of the crags of that stark mountain wall, and nothing that resembled a woman at all. But loitering home, at the last turn he turned, and in the distance saw her clear at last. A woman bowed in grief, and went his way. Ah, fortunate Pausanias, you discerned what even the wise ignore, that with the past a distant prospect may have more to say than all the pundits of analysis scrutinize close, and being near-sighted, miss. Author's note. Note 1. From Pausanias, Guide to Greece, translated by Peter Levy, Harmansworth, Middlesex, Penguin, 1971. Book 1, 21.5. Inside the cave, Apollo and Artemis are slaughtering the children of Niobe. I myself have seen Niobe when I was climbing up the mountains to Sipylos. Niobe from close up is a rock and a stream, and nothing like a woman, either grieving or otherwise. But if you go further off, you seem to see a woman downcast and in tears. Note 2, Pausanias, Book 8, 3-7. And they say Niobe on Mount Sipylos weeps in the summer. End of author's note. Canathos. I missed you, Pausanias, in the Argolid. Missed you by 18 centuries at least. Could we have met, although we never did, I would choose that Argive plain from all the rest. Argos. The Argolid. This was Hera's deem, dearest to her of any land in Greece. Here in her virgin majesty supreme she ruled and brought fertility and peace. She fought here with the earth-shaker and won, driving Poseidon back into his sea, just as Athena in Attica had done, and each by reason of her virginity. For these were goddesses whose names attest them older than Greece and its male pantheon, spirits of earth through whom the earth was blessed, by virtue of their maidenhood alone. Terrible are the powers that reside in virgin loins and in the virgin soul. Wisdom and prophecy to others denied are talents granted to their chaste control. Zeus seduced Hera basely in the shape of a sly suppliant, the cuckoo bird. The goddess, they say, never forgave that rape. This was a tale, Pausanias, that you heard in Argos from a woman's mystery, and to your credit would not divulge to men. Zeus made her queen of heaven and earth, but she yearly restored her virgin state again. In autumn, when the cuckoo leaves the land, striding towards Nauplion she could be seen, disowning her husband, spurning his command, a shadow against the stars, that angry queen. At the spring Carnathos, the gurgling well, she bathed at dawn, and then for all to see strode back, restoring to her land the spell of that renewed divine virginity. Lightning along the ridges flashed and ran, and women with dancers greeted her advance singing. But woe betide the reckless man who put himself in danger of that dance. These tales, Pausanias, enchant me more, because, like you, I went to Carnathos, neither, of course, intending to restore that state of which few men regret the loss. A house of nuns now guards it. How I wish we had gone there together, to have seen great Hera's bathtub full of Christian fish, and as the chaste nuns placed themselves between, might have exchanged a graceless masculine wink inspired by Zeus. But then would both agree to forego more research, for this we think better than to profane a mystery. Author's note. From Pausanias, Book 2, 38, 2. From Temenian to Nauplion is 6 or 7 miles, I suppose. Nowadays the place is abandoned. It was built by Nauplius, Poseidon's legendary son, by Amymone. There are still some ruins of the walls and a sanctuary of Poseidon, some harbours, a spring called Carnathos, where the Argives say Hera washes every year to renew her virginity. The legend about this belongs to the secrets of the mystery they celebrate to Hera. End of author's note. A fountain near Thalamae. The water from this spring runs babbling down. To hear it by moonlight still, they say, is best, but always gives a gabbling, garbled song. Two goddesses here contend, and both are strong. Sad Pasiphae yearns to be a moon-crowned beast, and Ino mourns no less the Theban crown. One Aphrodite loathed, and one she saved. Both shared the enchanted whiteness of the moon. Both were moon-crazed, and both were driven here by an implacable fate. One from the sheer cliff-leaping with her newborn child, and one by hopeless and unnatural love enslaved. And yet these waters prophesy. At night, travellers whose hearts are troubled or minds bemused come to the spring and make their pleas and sleep, till Ino's scream comes hurtling from the steep with the lost moon-child's wailing all confused and broken words that mock their human plight. Waking, the suppliants wash and fasting pray, and pour libations on that holy ground to each of those two crazed divinities whose oracle in a dream has brought release from guilt or grief. Then from their cares unbound, in calm and deep content, each goes his way. Author's note. From Pausanias, Book 3, 26, 1. The road from Oetalon to Thalamae is almost 10 miles, with a sanctuary and an oracle of Ino on the way. The oracles are given in sleep. Whatever people ask to be told, the goddess reveals it to them in dreams. There are bronze statues in the sanctuary in the open air, one of Pasiphae, the other of the sun. Fresh drinking water runs from a sacred water spring. Pasiphae is the title of the moon, not a local divinity of Thalamae. Note 2. Pasiphae, all shining, or appearing to all, is a common name of goddesses. I have applied it to the wife of Minos of Crete as if a moon goddess. End of author's note. The 13th labor. Thestios, father of 50 daughters. Thestios, Thestios, him I sing. 50 princesses, all of them beauties, all of them nubile, lively and mobile, eager and melting, sweeties, patooties, binding their tresses, dreaming of suitors, ripe for a fling. Think of Thestios, father and king. Even a father may find himself daunted, faced with the breakfast greetings of 50 ravishing misses and 50 nightly good-night kisses. Even a king, though rich and thrifty, may well be haunted night and day by the thought of 50 royal and king-sized dowries to pay. 50 pitchers empty a spring, alas for Thestios, father and king. Time for a miracle. Let the gods handle it. Thestios, Thestios, send to the temple. Ask of the oracle, what's to be done? Back comes the answer. Send for Heracles. Hear, O Heracles, thunderous son. Friend of the family, river god wrestler, slayer of monsters and righter of wrongs. Send to him, Thestios. Bid him to come to your banquet of beauty with drinking and dancing and amorous songs. Let all your pretty birds eye the young hero, dance for him, sport with him, revel and sing. He will know what to do. All shall be well with you. Fortunate Thestios, father and king. Heracles, Heracles, welcome to Thespiae, friend of my royal house, thunderous son. Now we have sacrificed, frolicked and reveled. The sun sea is setting, the banquet is done. Now let us talk a while, now while we can, since the hour waxes late. Since there are serious things to be said, finish our wine and settle as man to man matters of state. And you, my pretty chicks, pop off to bed. Bedtime is 6:30. Trim all your candle wicks. Off to your perches and head under wing. Do as your father bids, kind father Thestios, father and king. Look at them, Heracles, dear liabilities, lovely encumbrances. See how they run. Past my abilities, where in the whole wide borders of Greece can I make each a bride? Where shall I find for them husbands apiece? Tell me, friend Heracles, tell me, my boy, what's to be done? Heracles, hear, O thunderous son. Your father, mighty Zeus, would have devised a ploy. See what I mean? Well, I leave it to you. Come now, another drink, fill up your cup, one for me too. The son of a god such as Zeus, should know what to do. Know that a nod is as good as a wink. After them, Heracles, follow them up. Tell me at breakfast how the birds sing. Do this for Thestios, father and king. Heracles' hero mounted the stair. High in the zenith a star, in her paw the moon was a lioness leaving her lair. Low in the west shone the evening star, great Aphrodite's luminous car. Heracles mounted and stood by the door, listened and looked, for the door was ajar. Oh, what a chorus of clear voices there! Oh, what a bevy of beauties before mirrors undressing, combing their hair, girls all undressing, flitting and fluttering, 50 young virgins all in the roar, all of them muttering just the one word, Heracles, Heracles, was all he heard. Heracles entered and put out the light, took 50 maiden heads in the one night. 50 virginities fell at a blow. No one but Heracles could have done so. Every girl welcomed him, all the birds sang, everyone said the night went with a bang, everyone swore that it went with a swing. Blessings on Thestios, father and king. This tale, although it so shocked Pausanias, modest Pausanias, Hellas's guide, that he felt forced to set it aside, I, a coarse poet, take in my stride. Poets, like heroes, are not often gentlemen, rarely well-bred, apt to do just what enters their head. Heroes, they know, have most unconventional methods of dealing with monster or bride, many and various tricks up their sleeve. What scholars call scandalous, they find hilarious. What seems incredible, poets believe. And as for Thestius, Thestius, father of 50 bedable, fertile chicks, see him next morning at breakfast with Heracles, counting the chances that everything clicks, counting his chickens while still on the wing, reckoning, tallying, what should befall, winds in the treetops, whisper and croon, rock-a-bye babies, cradles and all. And what was the outcome at the ninth moon? What did the oracle finally bring? 52 grandsons, all to be heroes, mighty Heraclides. Fortunate Thestius, gratified Thestius, father and king. Author's note. Note 1. From St. Gregory Nazianzen, Contra Julianum. And this three night, Heracles engaging the 50 daughters of Thestius in a single night, and bringing this 13th labor to completion, although I hardly know how it could have been overlooked in the number of his labors. Note 2. From Pausanias, Book 9, 27, 5. They have at Thespiae a sanctuary of Heracles, where a virgin priestess serves until she dies. They say this is because Heracles slept with all the 50 daughters of Thestius in the same night, except for one. She alone refused to mate with him. Thinking she was insulting him, he sentenced her to be his virgin priestess all her life. I have also heard another legend about it, that Heracles went through all Thestius's virgin daughters on the same night, and they all bore him male children, but the youngest and the eldest bore him twins. But I am quite unable to believe that other story, that Heracles could behave so arrogantly to the daughter of a friend. End of author's note. Shepherds at Delphi. There were three simple shepherds, two men and a boy, and their wolf-rending sheepdogs ranging Parnassus to see what Poseidon, the shaker of mountains, whom mortals invoke as god of the terrible underground waters, had lately been up to in the valleys of Phocis. And what should they see near the spring of the Muses' Castalian fountain but an issue of steam from a gash in the flank of the god's holy mountain? Pausanias tells us they peeped in the crater till the fumes overcame them with poetic frenzy sent by Apollo, who held them accursed. The boy and his father and old Uncle Creon are said to have uttered his oracles first. And as for the sheepdogs, I put it to you. Had they not been daunted by the reek of the rock rift, who knows, they might well have prophesied too. The god had intended, of course, a quite different course to be followed. A dignified temple, a service of peons, a well-furnished altar, and oracles spoken or sung in bel canto by golden-mouthed sibyls, Boio and Hippo, and deep-minded Manto. Well, it just goes to show how even a god may find himself baffled by the innocent blunder of well-meaning rustics. And it prompts me to wonder how often the persons who call themselves poets may be peasants who stumbled by chance on the sacred sources of song. I could name you a dozen oracular scribblers of this generation, bards of my time who, by pure misadventure, having snuffed up a lungful, have burst into rhyme to get it all wrong. Author's note. From Pausanias, Book 10, 5, 3 and 4. Sometime later, they say Earth gave her share of Delphi to Themis, and Apollo got Themis's share as a gift. But he gave Poseidon the island of Poros off Troezen in exchange for this oracle. I have heard it said that some shepherds out with their herds first stumbled on this oracle and became possessed by the vapour and prophesied by the power of Apollo. But the greatest and most universal glory belongs to Phamonoe, that she was the god's first prophetess and the first to sing the hexameter. But a woman of the district called Boio wrote a hymn for Delphi. Second note from Peter Levy. Boio is a very obscure lady. Clement of Alexandria says the prophetic women called Boio, Hippo, and Manto. End of author's note. The Wild Bees. Botnia, Thesmophore Chrysanion. Mistress of bees, guardian of rites and forms, on a high bank by the prophetic stream which runs past Thespiae down from Helicon, a lad from Dog's Head, sleeping in the sun, first saw her picking flowers in his dream, while the wild bees behind her wheeled in swarms. A tall girl, tossing back her corn-gold hair, she strode towards him through the grass knee-deep. A meadow of Sicily and a reed-fringed pond, with a steep palisade of woods beyond, burned, glittered, and wavered round him in his sleep. She stood and held him with her violet stare, and said, "Why do you lie there, graceless boy? Get up and worship me. I am a god." But Pindar laughed, and rising on one knee, wound strong arms round her virgin thighs. "To me you are just a girl well met beside the road. To worship your body shall be my act of joy." She smiled and said, "For a still beardless youth you indeed show mettle, but you come too late for love. And though henceforward you are mine, we must meet in another place. The nine have marked your manhood for a different fate." She bent and kissed him lightly on the mouth, crying, "Golden rains, remember what I say." Darkness. A roar. The earth shook. He awoke to find his lips sealed with the waxen cells which wild bees swarming in the asphodels had moulded while he slept. And when he broke that seal, he sang, and singing went his way. That was the first of all his songs. He went towards Hippocrene and did not look behind, nor saw seated among the ancient trees a black-veiled form, her hands upon her knees, who standing seemed taller than womankind, nor earth absorb her as her element. Boys forget dreams, and Pindar, it is said, forgot Persephone, but he became the glory of Greece. Cities and men and gods he made immortal in still-living odes. Yet when he was old and full of years and fame, she came one night and stood beside his bed. She stood unveiled in her full majesty. "I made you a poet, Pindar," she began. "All other gods you honour, but me you wrong. You have never written me a single song, a graceless boy and an ungrateful man. Yet you shall make one when you come to me." She vanished. And if Pausanias's tale is true, the 10th day afterwards the poet died. An aged kinswoman of his, whose art had been to learn all Pindar's songs by heart, woke in the night to find him at her side, saying, "Learn this paean which I shall sing to you." Then the dead man opened his mouth and sang the chariot of Dis, the golden rains, the virgin goddess ravished underground, and her divinity with amaranth crowned. The door frames rattled at the dreadful strains, and the whole house with triumph and terror rang. He sang that Delphic priestess called the Bee, who had made him partner in Apollo's share. He sang dead heroes in their beehive tombs. He sang the tasting of the honeycombs which the wild bees in their dark caves prepare, the food of those the muses hold in fee. And the old woman sang it back again to bare walls, for the poet's shade had fled. And next she rose and wrote it word for word. This was the very paean Pausanias heard in Thebes, with Pindar then 6 centuries dead. And even today, 3 words of it remain. Goddess of the wild bees, renewer of rites, I have this curious story much in mind. I too am old. I too have practiced verse. The ancient superstitions I rehearse stir intuitions, though of another kind, such as I feel when visiting those sites. Do other beings inhabit our biosphere, whose life is one and whole? I cannot tell. I only know at moments everywhere I sense their presences in earth and air, mountain and cave, river and sacred well. Pausanias has been dead this many a year. I too must die, nor would I be reborn, but offer my death to quicken other lives, trusting, if in my turn I bring my song, deep underground my shade may taste that strong black honey from which alone our art revives, and share its resurrection with the corn. Author's note. From Pausanias, Book 9, 23:2. When Pindar was a very young man, he was on his way to Thespiae in the hot season, just at midday, when he was overcome by weariness and sleep. He lay down where he was, just above the road, and as he slept, bees flew up and made their wax on his lips. This was when Pindar began to compose songs. He was already famous all over Greece, when the Pythian priestess gave him even greater glory by telling the Delphians to give Pindar equal shares in the tithes they paid to Apollo. In his old age, they say he saw a vision in a dream. Persephone stood beside him in his sleep, and said she was the only god Pindar had never celebrated, but Pindar would write her a song all the same when he came to her. He died on the 10th day after that dream. There was an old woman in Thebes who was closely related to Pindar and had learned how to sing most of his songs. Pindar came to this old woman in a dream and sang a hymn to Persephone. As soon as the sleep left her, she wrote down everything she heard him singing in the dream. Among the titles of Hades in this song is Golden Rained, which obviously refers to the rape of Persephone. Note 2. Pindar was born at the village of Sinoscephalae near Thebes. End of author's note. Archilochus. There follows, in ancient Greek script, fragment 96 from Archilochus. Os thionesi anoktos kalon, exaxe melos itha thithiram von, enois igeranothis frenas. Homer? Homer to us is just a word. His Iliad tells us nothing of him at all. If possible, the Odyssey is worse. Archilochus, undeterred by caution or shame, was wholly personal, yet once was ranked with Homer for his verse. The poems of Homer have survived entire, but of Archilochus, unlucky dog, nothing but scraps and broken lines remain. And yet they pulse with force and fire. With him I hold unending dialogue, but labour to fix that savage spirit in vain. Archilochus, peerless poet of your age, singer of injuries, of neglect and wrong, traducer alike of enemy and friend, dealer in excrement and rage, slanderer, poison pen and scorpion tongue, where did it get you, poet, in the end? I was a spearman. For soldiers of the line, life in my day was thankless, grim and hard. Born out of wedlock, my mother was a slave. My sole defense was the divine gift which the gods impartially award to high or low. I used what gifts they gave. You made a joke of throwing away your shield, saying, I'll get another just as good. And to the highest bidder, you sold your spear. I ran, it is true. I did not yield. Until then, fought as stoutly as I could. Good sense may make men run as well as fear. What of the old man driven to suicide? Neobule and her sister in the noose, choking to death for the unbearable shame spread by your spite. I had my pride. If satire overwhelmed their crude abuse, I used it to protect my wounded name. But worse, Archilochus, bastard, slave girl's whelp, your drowned friends could not keep you from a feast. All your companions washed up on the shore, cold sea fruit, piled like kelp. I pledged them in wine. I made them a song, at least. They would have done the like for me, no more. You valued pride, yet yours was not the pride of well-born men that brought great Hector low and moved Achilles to honour a father's pleas. You boasted of what most men hide. That high tradition it was your luck to know, you mocked with the base scorn of Thersites. I am a soldier. I am a poet. I am a soldier's poet. That noble epic line I too could master, but I chose instead plain facts. There is no dithyramb, so said Cratinus, where there is no wine. I drank and washed those heroes from my head. Well, what does it avail you now? Your praise survives, but look and see what has become of all your poems. Tags quoted from the past, tatters from dunghills, a chance phrase on paper smeared by an Egyptian bum. To this, your life's whole work has come at last. Garbage at Oxyrhynchus spared my page better than Athens or Alexandria could, or Constantinople that passed their learning on. I cannot, I own, contain my rage, knowing the blundering muse of Hesiod spared, and my art swept to oblivion. Yet ruins of time, like the disasters of war, we accept, as rational men are bound to do. To live, to be forgotten. Each takes his chance. It has happened to poets before. You are a poet. It could happen to you to perish by the blind malice of circumstance. Surely the fates punish insolence now and then. Perhaps you incurred by the self-willed course you chose some god's displeasure or the muse's curse. No. If the muse should judge like men, what must we think of glorious Sappho, whose fragments and tatters match those of my verse? They say your mastery of the stinging word brings wasps to hover always round your tomb. They do, yes. But the inference is wrong. You have lived in Greece. You must have heard that wasps will gather to the honeycomb. What draws them is the unfailing honey of song. And I recall once in that house in Greece, breakfasting on our terrace in the sun on coffee and rolls and honey, how around the gold-striped wasps gave us no peace, but would not leave us till the meal was done. I hear Archilochus laugh from underground. Author's notes. Note 1. The epigraph. For I know how to raise the fine song of Lord Dionysus, the dithyramb, when my spirit has been struck by the thunderbolt of wine. Note 2. So said Cratinus. What Cratinus, Circa 520 to Circa 423, actually said was, there is no dithyramb when you drink water. Note 3. Archilochus mentioned the Sapaeans in an iambic poem from Pausanias, Book 7, 10, 2. To which Peter Levy comments, Archilochus was the first great individualist poet whose work we have, and the greatest of anti-heroic Greek writers. He mentions the Sapaeans in the famous lines about losing his shield. Some Scion has my shield. It was not the shield's fault. I hated to leave it, but I left it in a bush, got away with my life. What do I care about a shield? Goodbye, shield. The one I get will be as good. End of author's note. The People of the Pale. Friday's Child. Friday's Child is fine and neat. Friday's Child has dancing feet, formed for love and lovers' play, born on Venus' holiday. full of frolic, full of grace. When they look into her face, every creature is beguiled. All things smile on Friday's child. Thursday's child, and that am I, grieves to see her dancing by. Thursday's child is full of woe. Thursday's child stalks to and fro. All things, when they view his case, turn from that unhappy face, weeping till his heart grows wild for the love of Friday's child. The Waters. We sit in the deepening twilight in my room, talking of this and that as we always do. Events of the day, things we remember, news from home. And then, as always, the unforeseen breaks through. My heart, at some chance remark stilled with surprise, brings things together and finds their meaning plain, towards which I have groped for years. Some vast surmise takes shape and life from you. Now it happens again. You say, I see you always, a wide, calm lake, shining, serene, biding some ultimate call. But underneath, though the surface does not break, things surge in the depths which are not calm at all. And I, but you were a river, questing bound on its timeless errand. I see you range and veer round mountains, or when you must run underground, crying at every turn, not yet, not here, nor here. A quicksilver torrent, deep and swift in the gorges of custom, threading its prairies, secret and alone, with the liquid strength of urgent floods, whose urges sweep away cities and tunnel through sentinel stone. Yes, I wait in my stillness. You vary your restless course, but both must reject what other waters crave. The assurance of ends that match their means, the resource of those whose answers settle for what they have. All round us they call to us, dam and canal and pond. Life is here and now, the given, the useful task. Crazy waters, what is there to wait for beyond? What answers are there to questions one does not ask? What can we say to them? How can they understand? They have never heard of that universal sea which swallows whole continents yet rebuilds their land, whose summons is our blood, whose service keeps us free. So we sit in silence. Our darkening room is haunted by the voice of those ageless waters sweeping by. I think of the earth's great rivers whose names enchanted my boyhood, its vast lakes naked to the sky. Water to water, smiling, we turn to each other. The quest, the questions we live by hover between, and the wells of non-existence that most are content to smother break through to the surface and make our wilderness green. Those springs are the answer to all who tease and task us, the prophet's response to the leper's angry appeal. True, Abana and Pharpa, rivers of Damascus, are sweeter than Jordan. But can they save and heal? Riposta jaques. Yes, it was quite a bright idea to say that all the world's a stage. But what a way to act, without an audience and no play. We have our entrances and exits, true, but while on stage nobody tells us who we are supposed to be or what we do. Scene follows scene, but no one knows the plot, or if the action shows a theme or not. The dialogue, one fears, is mostly rot. Still there's some action, though by fits and starts, with others, of course, to play the walk-on parts. Each plays his sweet prince or her queen of hearts. But when the curtain falls, there's no applause. Each of us to his dressing room withdraws, takes off the grease paint, but is forced to pause to see at last emerging to the view in the dim glass a face we never knew, whose anonymity stares us through and through. Whom in the end, it asks, did we deceive? The actor, caught without his make-believe, bows to his double and prepares to leave. The lights go out. Doors slam. The streets resound our hollow footfalls. Now, as homeward bound, we walk alone to take the underground. The Alpha Omega Song. Quote, "Mad Mathesis alone was inconfined." End of quote. Pope. From harmony, from heavenly harmony, this universal frame began. So sang a prince of poets in an earlier day. In ours, although it makes no sense to me, cosmologists now favor one big bang. But who exploded what, they cannot say. What was it doing, that primeval stuff, before it went off pop? And why just then? Who gave the word, and what switched on the power? Did God by accident just let it off, or did he plan it, counting down from 10? Dryden, thou shouldst be living at this hour. Yours was a rational theory, glorious John. Ours is more typical of this violent age, whose music is discord and the battering drum. Things end as they begin. They may go on till doomsday, since big bangs are all the rage, and blast our universe to kingdom come. I still think harmony the likelier theme, and hope, as has so often been the case, that when tomorrow's cosmic model appears, it makes ours look a noisy schoolboy's dream, expels mad Mathesis from time and space, and brings us back the music of the spheres. The hills. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills. Psalm 121, verse 1. Not help alone comes from those hills, but peace, timeless content, and wonder and delight. They were our witnesses to the Spirit's release in their enchanted night. They took us in their arms and held us up, saying, "Here it is good to live and be alone. But having climbed your mountain to the top, now learn to be at one." They dared us with their silences, that vast landscape in which our miracle was set, and those deep vales conjoining, where at last our wandering rivers met, surprised in sharing touch and talk, to know our bread transfigured, our wine transformed by this babel of streams, rejoicing as they flow and plunge to the abyss. Beware of ruins. Beware of ruins. They have a treacherous charm. Insidious echoes lurk among their stones. That scummy pool was where the fountain soared. The seated figure whose white arm beckons you is a mock-up of dry bones, and not, as you believe, your love restored. The moonlight lends her grace, but have a care. Behind her waits the fairy Melusine. The sun, whose beams refract, died years ago. The moat has a romantic air, but it is choked with nettles, and obscene and phallic fungi rot there as they grow. Beware of ruins. The heart is apt to make monstrous assumptions on the unburied past. Though cleverly restored, the Tudor tower is spurious, the facade of fake, whose new face is a death mask of the last despairing effort before it all went sour. There are ruins, too, of a less obvious kind. I go back, cannot believe my eyes. The place is just as I recall. The fire is lit, the table laid, bed warmed. I find my former world intact, but not, alas, the man I was when I was part of it. The People of the Pale. Yesterday, was it only yesterday, we came back from the People of the Pale. The compound where they live is hidden away so that few now have heard of their strange tale. My father, who is the Commissioner for All Wildlife Reserves, took me along. Because the race is dying out, we were to see, he said, the last of an old song. The loneliest place in Asia, one would say, preserves these remnants of archaic men. We went by air first, travelling north all day over vast wastes of tundra, lake and fen. Then 50 kilometres of spruce and pine, through which the road ran straight without a curve to gates in a high fence which bore a sign, Forbidden Zone, Keep Out, White Race Reserve. My father, of course, was greeted by the head keeper, at whose house we spent the night. I asked him just before we went to bed, what does it mean by saying those people are white? Everyone knows the human race is brown. Are they albinos? Is it a disease? Is it catching, Dad? He answered with a frown, no, nothing like that. Far stranger than all these. But no more questions now. High time for bed for you, my dear. Indeed, for both of us. But Keeper has papers here that must be read before I sleep, and questions to discuss. I could not sleep that night for a great wind which made the forest roar with sullen rage. I found it horrible to imagine white men, white women, a white girl of my age. So after breakfast, when the keeper said, all ready, I said, I think I will not go. He laughed. The white giants, miss? Don't be afraid. They are a gentle sort of folk, you know. You will see them in their village. They number now only a couple of hundred at the best, having lost the will to live. Your father, though, I understand, prefers to tell the rest. White giants. That was a shock. Indeed, they reared over real men more than 2 meters tall, and their pale skins were ghastly, but really weird. The most unnerving thing, the worst of all, were their strange eyes. Imagine, they were blue. Unlike the human eyes, soft, lucid brown, their ice-blue glances seemed to pierce me through. Blue lakes that drew me in and sucked me down. Their huts were built of logs and thatched with reeds. One had a tower from which a bell tolled loud to summon their men and women. I must needs add that I saw few children in the crowd. The great blonde creatures came and drifted round and stood to listen indifferently. They had a listless air, and when they spoke, the sound was hollow. Their gaunt, pale cheeks were drawn and sad. Their speech was an odd murmuring noise. It felt like echoes relayed from the archaic past. The keeper interpreted as my father dealt with their requests, and I stared aghast at creatures so unnaturally fair. The long straw-coloured beards among the men. The women were worse, with blanched and braided hair. There was a girl, too, maybe 9 or 10, who seemed already a little above my height, and I am 16 and considered tall, smiling at me. But for that leprous white, in spite of myself, I could not smile at all. I am sorry for that. Watching those waxen ears, that mouth, a red gash in the freckled skin, I realized when the blue eyes filled with tears she had touched me by that cheerful, childish grin. After the meeting we saw their tilth and sword. It was incredible. We saw them plough with horse-drawn instruments the keeper averred had been in use 10,000 years ago. They took my father hunting, while I saw around their village and some scattered farms. In each hut was a lamp that burned before a pictured woman with a babe in arms. Time passed. I felt my first disgust recede and yield to pity, much to my surprise. They showed such dignity in word and deed, and such profound despair in their sad eyes, so that when keeper came, I could not wait to ask my father what their story was. But after dinner I had to sit up late while he conferred with keeper, and because it seemed we were to leave next day at dawn. But when he came, I had to hear their tale. Who are they, Dad? Why are they so forlorn? Why are they called the people of the pale? He smiled and took my hand beside the fire. I see they have won your sympathy, my dear. So, briefly, since we both must soon retire, I shall try to make their curious story clear. Well, child, you know your history. But there lies a period before history begins, half archaeology and half surmise, the lost age of the people with white skins. The current theory, for what it may be worth, is that there was a white race long ago, whose culture dominated the whole earth. Ours was comparatively late and slow. They were a turbulent folk, and in the end destroyed themselves and half the world by war. The Dark Age followed. Well, we don't pretend to know much of it, or what went before. When history starts, 3,000 years ago, with the great African Empire, there were still large bands of white men wandering to and fro. The pale-faced nomads, they were called. They fill no page in history. The next 1,000 years saw them become extinct. There is no doubt their white genes were recessive. It appears they interbred with us and were phased out. A random instance of blue eyes, a case of blonde hair, would crop up long afterwards. It must be ages now since one took place. The last white birth no chronicle records. For centuries, of course, nobody knew. The great white race had vanished past recall. Our brown race, it seemed obviously true, and humankind were just identical. Until in the last century, pushing forth to find the limits of this Eurasian plain, in the vast woods of the uncharted north, explorers found the lost white race again. They were peasant farmers and hunters, very much as they appear now, obstinate, slow, resigned. They thought themselves, being so long out of touch, the only living creatures of their kind. They called themselves the Buhatia Narod, though what that means is anybody's guess. Some say it means the warriors of God, but for such mild folk, that seems foolishness. World Council, since they were so pure a stock, decided to preserve and fence them in. Scientists studied their habits round the clock, charted the genes that give them their white skin, studied their language, a quite unknown type, their kinship patterns, their ethnic heritage, folklore and legends, till the time seemed ripe to educate them for the modern age. We offered them our culture, the whole range of science, our technology, our art. They turned us down. They did not wish to change their way of life at all in any part. World Council, of course, accepted their decision, with all that such decisions must entail. There must be absolute and clear division between us and the people of the Pale. We see they want for nothing, but year by year their numbers dwindle. You ask why should that be? Because we fenced them in, one cause is clear. Some species won't breed in captivity. But there are other reasons. Though they mate quite normally, we notice more and more marriages prove infertile, and of late, more births malformed than was the case before. This and their gigantism are a sign of populations too minimal to breed true. And since at last they have crossed that fatal line, nothing can save them now that we can do. We offered to cross-fertilize them. They, with horror that scarcely flattered us to be sure, refused, preferring to perish in their own way, keeping their stock, like their tradition, pure. Well, that's their tale, girl. In your life, perhaps, the tale will end. The great white race will be, after this second and wholly final collapse, only a curious fading memory. One thing he added. It seemed appropriate in view of their strange history, because this doomed race, so determined on their fate, worship a dying god nailed to a cross. Lights out, I stood long staring through the pane towards the people out there so soon to die, till the dark forest stirred, and stirred again, as though the earth had uttered a long sigh. Creation. And God said, "Let there be a cup of tea." And there it was. But how could it just be? How could God, even though he had a thirst, disrupt the harmony of first things first, overturn cause, and by mere evocation subvert the order and logic of creation? How could there be a cup of tea, with no kettles and caddies, hobs or hearths to glow, with no camellia tear, no taprobane, cups, cooks, taps, mains, no rivers and no rain, no milk, no milk jug, not a single cow was yet invented? No earth, anyhow. It was too much. Lucifer, standing by, could not resist the impulse to ask why. God smiled and sipped. "I knew you would ask that. Take care now. Curiosity killed the cat." "Cats haven't been thought of yet," said Lucifer. "Well then, why whip the cat as if they were? Your trouble, Lou, old man, is that you must justify all you mean to do or bust. Imagination's fruitful leap in the dark is quite beyond you, terrified to bark up a wrong tree, and just as terrified of an unearned good guess. The sin of pride, if you persist in logic-chopping, friend, trust me, will be your downfall in the end. Now look at me. I have a thirst. I think, what would it taste like, that ideal drink? Warm, soothing, and refreshing, just the way to pause between my first and second day. A first cause needs some respite. In a trice, my fiat concocts this draught of paradise. But try a cup yourself. Relax, good sir. Presto! Let there be two cups." And there were. Jupiter on Juno. Tantaene animis caelestibus irae. "So that's her latest feat of espionage. There she goes off in an immortal huff, slams out with a last shriek of heavenly rage. When, she wants to know, will you leave off chasing mortal girls and learn to be your age? Are not the pleasures of my bed enough? She knows too much, I tell her. Even so, I am tempted to tell her what she does not know. She does not know how tedious they become, these goddesses, forever young and fair, flaunting their regal charms of bust and bum, queening their way with that Olympian air of effortless, nonchalant equilibrium, untouched by doubt, by weakness or despair. Complacent virgins and self-righteous wives who never took a risk in all their lives. She cannot conceive the wonder, the mere bliss of loving a woman, who at her peak and prime senses her beauty doomed to the abyss, who in the inexorable lapse of time must take her chance, knowing how frail it is, yet daring the unknown, achieve sublime ardor she could not know me capable of, and reaches raptures past her hope of love. She cannot imagine how humanity flowers from aspirations of which gods have no need to be caught up in this divine of ours. How ecstasy, when laced with terror, can breed spasms of vision, and vision lend them powers of divination. How pregnant with my seed, their bodies grown strange, crave metamorphoses to other natures, beasts, stone, stars, or trees. What prompts them in such shapes to welcome me? What goddess visited by bull or swan would not just laugh or turn in scorn and flee? They know me far too well. With women alone I tap the human springs of fantasy, and in their arms, as never in heaven, have known that sense of undiscovered light which broods in mortal poetry's similitudes. Woman is half a living metaphor that reaches towards its unknown counterpart. No goddess needs apotheosis, nor any fulfillment of the mind and heart. Nothing that she may think worth wishing for demands imagination, knowledge, or art. All things being in her power to attain, what she enjoys, she may enjoy again. So what words could I find that would convey the pleasure of sensing worlds beyond my reach in mortal minds, where mine must beat its way from dim surmise to final lucid speech? I, threading their labyrinths of doubt, while they dazzle through ether, probing each to each, I towards her tender dark mortality, and groping to discern my Newman, she. In that embrace how exquisite, how brief the mind's exchange, the body's precarious joy. Transfigurations of spirit beyond belief for those whom easy unending pleasures cloy. For once to know and share the urge, the grief heightening 1 hour, the next hour must destroy. Yet how explain to an immortal wife that single hour might be the crown of life? What good, of course, would explanation do, when all that counts with her has just been said? What past resentments must it not renew? What tears of jealous fury would she shed? Omnipotence leaves so little to pursue, omniscience less to talk about in bed, and I, no conversationalist, I admit, shine more in love's performance than its wit. Still she's a heavenly creature, bountiful and splendid even in anger. What is more, how can I blame her godhead being so dull? Her immortality must prove a chore, did not some screaming rage restore the full. Now why have I not thought of this before? The full immediacy, that zest of strife, and plural of spouse, which is the spice of life. Inscription for a war. Stranger, go tell the Spartans we died here, obedient to their commands. Inscription at Thermopylae. Linger not, stranger, shed no tear. Go back to those who sent us here. We are the young they drafted out to wars their folly brought about. Go tell those old men, safe in bed, we took their orders and are dead. Four epigrams. 1. Education. This intricate world, we make it worse each day, grows such a labyrinth that by and by, preparing for life, learning to find our way, we'll leave at last no time except to die. 2. Arms and the men. They also serve who only stand and wait to take advantage of the needs of state. And when the hour comes that they waited for, cry profit and let loose the hogs of war. 3. On the Blake Prize for Religious Painting. Holy Jesus, what is this? 30 silver shekels paid, Judas plants his abstract kiss on his saviour, twice betrayed. 4. Reply to a critic. You fail to keep up with the times. I quite agree. Let the times change course and try to keep up with me. Romancero. Ambushed by some wild Basques at Thornydale, a baggage train perishes in the Pyrenees. So, Einhart, in his Life of Charlemagne. 3 centuries pass. A poet retells the tale. Roland's disaster, riding home from Spain, becomes more glorious than most victories. History gives way to epic, as it should. Heroic deeds from commonplace facts are born. Still down the centuries, echoing from the steep, as the long, desperate day goes down in blood, resound the dying notes of Roland's horn. But man's imagination cannot sleep. Epic, in turn, gives way to high romance. The epic poets, at most, replaced a few Basque bandits by that countless Saracen host, a mere task force by the 12 peers of France. But with the poets of romance is lost all sense of the fantastic or the true. And Durendal, great Durendal, the sword which Roland in the epic could not break, now in romance becomes a valiant knight who fell at Roncesvalles beside his lord. And Montesinos, who survived that fight, unknown to epic, was at first a snake. Things flow, things drift. Things swirl and change like mist. Belerma, oh Belerma, what were you before you fondled Durandarte's heart, cherished 9 years and handled, mourned and kissed? Were you perhaps your lover's counterpart, Belode's bare bodkin and her poignard too? Ruidera next. 6 daughters and a niece or two so wept at Durandarte's grave that Merlin, who by now was in the act, turned them all 9 into a pond apiece. Don Quixote had it told him for a fact by Montesinos in his magic cave. 3 centuries of scholarship with its frost nipped back those tender crops of a new age and ruined the harvest of Cervantes' day. Epic, romance, each in its turn was lost, and pure research having restored his page, now sober history is here to stay. Truth, as they say, is great and shall prevail. I have no quarrel with that. But what of rhyme, whose truth is vision, whose task to guard the pass with Roland or seek with Galahad the Grail? For those who gaze in her enchanted glass, time has an end, whose end is not in time. Anniversary Ode, 1577 to 1977. Quando sarà che pueda libre desta prisión volar al cielo, Felipe en la rueda que huye más del suelo, contemplar la verdad pura sin duelo. Luis de León, Oda a Felipe Ruiz, 1577. When at the last we can, freed of this prison of sense, freely descry the illimitable plan, Fray Luis, you and I, spread out majestic as the starry sky, the centuries between your world and mine must dwindle to a day as though they had not been. And smile to hear you say, your dicabamus hysterna die. Yet, speaking mind with mind in that pure wordless mirror which Dante saw, what difference shall we find? What different concepts draw from our 2 separate visions of natural law? You, writing to your friend in 1577, conceive a sky in which mount and descend spirits of those who die, and angels who on God's occasions fly. A sky whose moon and sun and the fixed stars in their revolving sphere upon earth's axis spun prove all is neat and near, with God in human form to forge and steer. A modest universe, where God rides on the clouds and drives his car, though in the year your verse was penned, a hairy star seen at Oranaborg presaged not war, but this new earth and heaven of frame and scale not dreamed of in your day. In 1977 we can no longer say with you, as we were saying yesterday, your Ptolemaic gyres dissolve. We see earth orbit round the sun. The sun himself retires, a minor star, and one of millions in our galaxy alone. The fixed stars of your day scatter each way we turn. They fade and flee. Galaxies pass away. Among their myriads we shrivel to dust in that immensity. Our cosmos, ruled by blind energy, is darkly thrust towards ends unknown. We search and yearn to find some voice to greet our own, and meet with silence and an empty throne. For he has taken his leave, your God, whose man-like image rode the storm, a being who could conceive such worlds and frame and form, what human mind could touch, what heart could warm. Life of the intellect, Fray Lewis, would not trouble you, I know. Nor would your heart reject, however keen the blow, truth demonstrated plainly to be so. As in your prison cell, your faith would shine as lucid and serene. Your spirit flash as well beyond the sensory screen, and reach the source and pierce to the unseen. Returning from this height, we should resolve things in this world below. What guides the seasons right? Such things you long to know. The cause of tides, the source of storms and snow. What pleasure to discuss things since made plain, to reason and foretell, and things still hid from us to contemplate as well. The structures of the atom and the cell. And yet no less than yours to know our century's vision, a fleeting view. Tomorrow other doors must open unto new prospects and unguessed vistas to pursue, by which what we now see may seem a sketch scrawled by a child at play. To every age may be old ignorance swept away, the mystery merely deepens day by day. Fray Lewis, I reach to you in golden Salamanca, from a land of which you never knew. Fellows in that rare band, whose joy is still to learn and understand. I reach towards the light, that primal radiance you too strove to find. In vain we question sight, the eye of sense is blind. The source is in the heart and in the mind. Author's note. Dicabamus Asterna D.A. The famous remark attributed to Luis de Leon on resuming his lectures at the University of Salamanca after 5 years in a prison of the Inquisition. A hairy star seen at Oranaborg. Tugo Brahe's observation of a comet as seen from two different observatories enabled him to prove that it was beyond the moon, and thus to call the Ptolemaic picture of the universe in question. Actually, his observation was probably made before his observatory at Oranaborg, Sky Castle, was built. End of author's note. Obad. She will not come now. Turn and sleep again. Hear the winds blow. Listen to the rain. Lying here awake, you already knew. Day begins to break. What is left to do? No step on the stone, no hand at the door. You must sleep alone, now and evermore. The Legend of the Myrrh Tree. Balsamodendron, Myrrh. Who is this that cometh out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? Behold his bed, which is Solomon's. The Song of Songs, 3, 6, and 7. The legend of these incense-bearing trees is told by Ovid in the episode of Myrrh in his Metamorphoses. Young, ardent Myrrh, princess of the blood, on whom the vengeful Aphrodite cast madness, a frenzy of unnatural love. Poor child, it overmastered her at last. No matter how she agonized and strove with shame and dread against that gross desire for union with her father and her king, the goddess only added to her fire. A nurse in darkness so arranged the thing that when she crept into her father's bed, trembling for love, and trembling even more with horror at her act, so Ovid said, the ancient nurse kept watch outside the door. Night after night for ecstasy she wept. By day she wept for triumph, for guilt, for fear. The king rejoiced, not knowing with whom he slept, till the lamp kindled made his shame too clear. In the soft glow of that accusing light she woke, and shrieked to see him draw his sword, and fled stark naked out into the night. Full of her father, it is Ovid's word, and wandering through a friendless world and wide, broken and big with child and near her time, in her despair on all the gods she cried, if any god would help in such a crime. Yet some god listened to her misery, disdaining man-made law, and pitying her because she loved much, changed her to a tree, from which her tears still ooze as fragrant myrrh. Sweet myrrh, which grows in the Sabaean waste where myrrh found surcease, is nonetheless, though heavenly fragrant, bitter to the taste, and its Arabian name means bitterness. Its perfume in the ancient East was said, as smoke of incense garnered from this tree, to summon back the spirits of the dead and give men union with divinity. In unguents it enhanced the glowing bride, and with miraculous vigour nerved the groom, and mixed with holy nard for those who died, kept fresh their corpses, even in the tomb. Myrrh was the gift the Queen of Saba brought, which perfumed all the house of Solomon that night when on her body he begot the Lion of Judah, Menelik, their son. Myrrh was the gift the Magi brought the child, whose virgin mother Solomon's God had wed, quickening her womb. Her flesh, left undefiled, brought no betrayal of the marriage bed. That child became a god, and preached new laws of love, but set the godly all astir, saying of the wanton Magdalene, because she loved much, much is now forgiven her. So that his enemies, thinking him a man, to trap him and then nail him to the tree, once brought before him in their subtle plan a woman taken in adultery. "Ay, in the very act, master," they said, brandishing cruel stones, "what must we do? Shall we, as Moses bade us, stone her dead? Preacher of love and mercy, what say you?" He stooped, and with his finger in the dust wrote something in a script to them unknown, then rising said, "The laws he made are just. Let him who has not sinned first cast his stone." And bent again to his mysterious script, ignoring their silence, which went on and on, ignoring their trembling victim, bound and stripped. When he looked up, the lynching crowd had gone. For one by one, each conscious of his sin, troubled in heart, faltered and crept away and left the woman unharmed. This much is in the Gospel of St. John. It does not say what an old legend adds, not known before, but when Christ bade her go and said to her, "Neither do I condemn you, sin no more," the air was heavy with the smell of myrrh. Salabanjika. Salabanjika, inmate of my house, you have hung for years over the kitchen sink, cut from some brochure about Indian art, my wife, my niece, to fortify their vows against the insidious lures of meat and drink, pinned you, voluptuous, by their diet chart. My own response to your delightful frame, those generous breasts, the bold haunch, the full thighs and rapt face, did it seem to dream or brood, has naturally been not quite the same. Symbols of plenty to my masculine eyes, abundance and promise, grace and plenitude, and mystery. India, from which you sprung, its arts, its past, past, and its unnumbered gods was at that time to me almost unknown. I saw you as a woman, enchanting, young, and did not know by what improbable odds my kitchen harboured your smile of ageless stone. I used to think you in my ignorance one of those lovers who endlessly embrace at Connerac on its temple of the sun in every erotic posture known to man's power to create supple and sensual grace. At other times I saw you as a lone dancer at some Maharaja's court. The Nizam, with a connoisseur's cool glance, followed the fluid ecstasy of the Nautch, appraising the pearl his boundless wealth had bought, ignoring the exquisite artistry of the dance in contemplation of his coming debauch. Mere fancies. Now I have visited your land, viewed you and your voluptuous sisterhood, and know you for a goddess of the trees. Yours is no dancer's pose. As the trees stand true to the zenith and draw up their green blood, the classic stance of Hindu dryades, but older than all Hindu gods, as old as the first worshippers on that continent, you stand, straight torso, weight upon one foot, the other drawn back and poising to withhold its touch, the arms uplifted, the knee bent. The legend was, one kick against the root made the tree blossom from contact with the heel of any beautiful woman, but blossom more caressed by such a spirit of the wood, since all trees have a deep desire to feel a woman's touch, and will give all their store of nectar, colour, fragrance if they should. The legend charms me. I do not think it true, and yet I long to put it to the test. Now I am old, and in my season of fruit, shriveled by drought, I too would turn to you, if by contact with foot or lip or breast my buds might burst or water drench my root. Bring me, Sala Banjika, what your smile portends, that miracle of late blossoming. But till that moment comes which sets all free, pause, let me feel my new sap rise a while. Then flood me with that providential spring. Touch, tend, and make me flower. I am that tree. Author's Notes. Note 1. Sala Banjika, a female figure from Giraspur, Madhya Pradesh, Gurjava Pratihara period, circa 11th century AD, Archaeological Museum, Gwalior. The figure probably represents Sala Banjika, a tree spirit. Rustam J. Mehta, Masterpieces of Indian Sculpture, Bombay, Tarapovala, 1968, page 44. Note 2. Sala Banjaka Sana. Sala Banjaka equals tree breaking. This is the classic pose of dryades or tree goddesses of ancient Hindu sculpture. Body upright, weight resting firmly on one foot, the ball of the other foot on the ground with heel raised and knee bent. It is so called from the belief that a beautiful woman can make a tree blossom by giving it a kick. Benjamin Walker, The Hindu World, London, Allen and Unwin, 1968, Volume 1, page 76. Note 3. Some trees are said to have a doda, or violent desire for the touch or attention of a beautiful woman. Benjamin Walker, The Hindu World, London, Allen and Unwin, 1968, Volume 2, page 144. End of author's notes. Making Love. "What are you doing?" he said. They said, "We are making love." "Is it made in the heart or the head? And what do you make it of?" "That is hard for us to say. We make it up as we go. And it vanishes away as soon as it's made, you know." "What instruments go to make such fleeting and fragile stuff?" "Two hearts that rejoice and ache for each other are quite enough.
Is it easy to make?
Oh, yes. Though there's no sure rule for it. Each time we must gamble, and guess how this time the pieces fit. But what when their joiners cease, and the makers can make no more? Then it leaves the spirit at peace. But the heart sore. The Cetaceans. What do they think of with their enormous brains, our brothers the mammals who went back to the sea? Comparative anatomy explains, in the light of man's conjectural family tree, that several of the many cetacean strains could well be more intelligent than we. A pity we cannot meet them and discuss such things, and ask them what they think of us. True, they have nothing very much to show for all that cerebral armature and gear, but we ourselves, we recollect, were slow to learn to chip flint, fashion bow and spear, though given so many millennia ago brains fit to rival Einstein or Shakespeare. It took us 20 centuries or more just to discover what a brain was for. And they perhaps even yet are not aware that brains exist, much less what they can do. Which we, unlike them, furnished with a pair of busy hands and scalpels, never knew till yesterday. Nourishment of the hair as the brain's task was Aristotle's view, and Aristotle's day is but a span behind ours in the history of man. But if no porpoise, whale, or dolphin yet has built a gadget to explore the land, or toiled at the invention of a net to catch himself a human and expand his knowledge or his power, maybe we set our sights on the wrong course to understand or judge the use of an intelligence which may have flowered in quite another sense. Their thinking could be much more like the sea in which it formed, as ours is of the shore. Ours, definite, purposeful, analytic, as we surmise our future from what went before. Theirs by a fluid environment set free, elusive, flowing, untrammeled to explore the whole of being, and from it to express tides of an oceanic consciousness. For we are fenced by hopes, desires, and fears, by individual purpose and design. We analyze space by miles and time by years. They, with no need to measure or define, ignore what we call science. We could find theirs unbounded as the waters which align contours of every coast and bay or cape, though ocean knows no frontiers and no shape. A mind clairvoyant and ventriloquial, able to echo each least voice that occurs, yet able to reach out and encompass all. Each galaxy spinning, every mote that stirs, all minds responsive to its cosmic call, reverberant from the whole universe. Could we conceive of such transfluent powers beyond the grasp of one-way minds like ours? Such crude imagining surely missed the mark. Lost in the human, how could we hope to guess? By what improbable surmise in the dark unravel the mystery of their otherness? As well share soul with octopus or shark and probe their primitive modes of consciousness, or translate wordless minds to human speech, or bring ourselves to that archaic beach to whose warm tide so long ago some hesitant ancestor of mammals crept, drawn there perhaps like whales to die, though no memory of the sea survived except what draws us still to its oblivious flow. Faint intuitions which all flesh has kept, tides in our blood which urge all equally, some towards the shore, and others towards the sea. Why else should they so often, as people say, when seized by a mysterious urge to die, leave the high seas and swim into some bay to ground themselves among the shallows? And why, when towed back to deep water, straightway do they come back to be left high and dry by the next tide and perish on the sand? Unless old memories drive them to the land. Perhaps the solid earth they left behind for the wide waters haunts them in their dreams in their wet purblind world and crowds the mind with fantasies of woodland slopes and streams. Could they recall the deserts as a kind of hell? Or have they ancient myths whose themes are vengeful gods who banished them to the sea from which their souls return eventually? There, in the landscape of such visions, they roam the meadows of their earthly paradise, and there at last, from wandering, each comes home to his own plot, a thing the sea denies. And what as denizens of the trackless foam, unused in the long lapse of centuries they lost, their spirits resume, land limbs at last, still as vestigial bones in flesh held fast. And there, those former hands and feet restored, their spirits at that blessed metamorphosis break into dance upon the springy sward, while from the mountain to complete their bliss, the half-remembered gods they once adored, with hands like theirs to touch, with mouths to kiss, on feet like theirs, with welcoming tread advance, and greet their souls redeemed and join the dance. Yet these are human fancies after all, built on our myths of supernatural powers, Eden and heaven, redemption and the fall. Such myriad years divide their minds from ours, imagination cannot breach that wall. Our alien worlds are raised as time devours what common memories might have been a base for fruitful intercourse between each race. One thing at any rate we can surmise. We think in terms of shape and colour, but they in the dim waters have less use for eyes. They live by sound. By sound they find their way, speak to each other, and their re-echoed cries warn them of perils and help them find their prey. And they have music. We have recorded the strong cadences of the humpback whale's strange song, and of the right whale too. Strange songs indeed. Yet they create, it seems, as humans do. And it is art, not instinct, serves that need. Each year some singers compose the songs anew, and the rest follow the composer's lead. As in our world, the genius of the few provides unceasingly from age to age renewed delight, a growing heritage of song. And such invincible harmonies can fill the vast Pacific tract entire from shore to shore, and then return with ease, caught and swelled by that tremendous choir. Each adding new motifs, new felicities, sheer from Kamchatka to the land of fire, and could indeed make the whole globe resound with the re-echo of that mighty round. Since they have speech, and listen, and reply, test of real language from its spurious shell of animal signals and mere mimicry, and would learn ours, as far as we can tell. It would seem natural not to deny them fiction and fancy, and poetry as well. Though poems of their experience of the sea might be strange, as their music seems to be. They should have poems of life, and death, and love, such as all creatures able to think and feel would have, of mysteries. The stars above, or what the unplumbed ocean deeps conceal. But what of man? What could those poems be of but senseless slaughter, of implacable steel hurled by beasts mad for train oil or for food, and seven oceans boiling with their blood? Yet still the dolphins seek our company, unmindful of that blood so cruelly spilt. Play with our children in the surf, while we, unable to control our rankling guilt, hunt them with our harpoons. In every sea in goes the murderous weapon to the hilt, and cold greed, more effective than blind hate, drives them all to extinction, soon or late. Lack of company other than his kind may prove man's tragedy. In his last despair of love and free companionship of mind, he shouts for answers, an unanswered prayer. The gods his hopes implore turn deaf and blind. Probing the void, he finds nobody there. And rival strains to his on land we know he had exterminated long ago. And so, too late perhaps, since in the past we killed all minds that might have matched our own, now we turn desperately to this last cradle of kind and hope from the unknown. Outcast from life, self-doomed to be outcast, crying, comfort us, speak to us, say we are not alone. Cherish us in the wilderness we have made, and where we wander, unfriended and afraid. In Memoriam, Ian Maxwell, 1979. Much travelled, much winning in the realms of gold, all whom he taught to share his enterprise with Milton drank the milk of paradise. Observed the human comedy unfold with Scott. With Boswell visited the Grand Cham's territories, or heard True Thomas sing. These held his youth, but with time's ripening, the North's Valhöll became his promised land. Its fjords and fells his country of the heart, its elder tongue his treasure. I see him there as his friends see him, smiling at the chart of Iceland, a Viking looking from his eyes. The man of action in the scholar's chair, like Gunnar Gentle and like Ari Wise. Author's note. This poem originally appeared in Iceland and the Medieval World under the title IRM, as preface to a volume of essays in honour of Ian Maxwell. End of author's note. Homage to Anna Akhmatova, for Amanda Haidt. Author's note. The poems in this collection are for the most part translations of poems by Anna Akhmatova, or based on other poems of hers. In the case of Letter to Amanda and A Northern Elegy, the translations in italic type are incorporated in my own poem. I have tried as far as possible to render the originals literally without the amplification and paraphrase so often the recourse of translators of poetry. A few notes are added for readers who may not be conversant with events and settings or with references in individual poems. The translations themselves provide further background. End of author's note. Narrator's note. In preparing this section, I decided to use my own natural voice when Hope himself is speaking, but for the translations of Akhmatova, a much lighter tone. End of narrator's note. Letter to Amanda. Author's note. The reference is to the book Akhmatova, A Poetic Pilgrimage, by Amanda Haidt. London, Oxford University Press, 1976, and in particular to the meeting of Akhmatova in 1965 with her old friend Salomea Halpern during Akhmatova's visit to England to receive an honorary doctorate from Oxford University. Salomea Nikolaevna Andronikova, a Georgian princess and a great beauty in Petrograd before the Russian Revolution, had been celebrated in a poem by Mandelstam under the name of Solominka, Little Straw, a pun on her Christian name. Akhmatova, too, during a period of persecution and neglect under the Stalin terror of the 40s, had celebrated her in poem with the title of Shade. A translation of the poem is included in Letter to Amanda. Akhmatova, according to her friend Lydia Chukovskaya, never learnt to cook. End of author's note. Letter to Amanda. Noyezhli vayotkuda to vizhglianula, yana svoyu tepesh noyu shizn, uznala vayad zavist nakonyets. Having read your book, Amanda, I turned back to read and read again one marvellous scene, in which those friends, miraculously alive from the disasters of death's almanac, recall their memories of the years between, meeting at last in 1965. Little Straw and the Sorceress from Kiev, in old age, in a London kitchen, where they stand forever in history now. Not just two old biddies gossiping by a stove, which some might take them for, nor just a pair of ghosts in their reanimated dust, but Phoenix and Firebird issuing from their embers. Two queens, magnificent in exile, greeting each in the other's ruin her pride of state. Two goddesses whose rights no man remembers, by night between their broken altars meeting. Such images of time and loss and fate I sought, Amanda. But it will not do. These were real women of our century, who shared with others their epoch's common plight. War, exile, revolution they lived through as others did. And yet it seems to me each was a sorceress in her own right. One, that great poet, who, when others broke, ignored what Stalin's terror had decreed, chose the free mind, though death was in that choice, became a sibyl through whom a dumb world spoke, stones found a tongue, wind or a roadside weed, and tyranny's victims an articulate voice, the subject of your book, Akhmatova. The other, that Georgian princess, Salomea, whom, when recalling what their world had been in Peter's granite town on the Neva, the poet, evoking that fatal final year, called Beauty of the Year 1913. That poem you translated, Amanda, I have ventured to render once again in rhyme. It's Indian summer of Petropolis, late sunset red in an imperial sky. The gaiety and the beauty of that time, already tottering to the abyss. Yet it goes cheerfully, no dying fall. The voice is young, no overtone of tears. Streets glitter, and the carriages glide and pass. Always more elegant, statelier than all and rosier, from the pit of the dead years your wavering limpid profile behind glass. Why does my greedy memory call you back? Were you bird or angel? We bickered on that theme. What time a poet nicknamed you Little Straw, and softly radiant shining through those black lashes your Darialian eyes would beam, calmly appraising everything you saw. But then, Amanda, as though a sob broke through, the whole tone changes. Enter death and war. Oh, shade, forgive me, but this marvellous weather, reading Flaubert, and my insomnia too, and the late lilac, and yourself, the star of 1913. Well, all this together, your day, so nonchalant and so serene, they bring it back. But not now, not for me. Such memories will not do. Oh, shade. Oh, shade. There the voice breaks. You see now what I mean. A shaft of sudden sunlight on the sea, that laughter in the kitchen, unafraid after such years of terror. Leningrad, her city demolished, the 900 days, the waiting in Tashkent for the world's end, that winter in 1940, when half mad she foresaw all, and wrote that poem in praise of her lost world, and Salomea her friend. Hugging the last resources of despair, destitute, often starving, there she sat, silenced, abused and threatened, old and frail, and dauntless. Sitting in her broken chair, I see her summon up light and joy, and that is why your rounding off this winter's tale delights me so. The agony of the past resolved, once more in other shapes appear Demeter and Persephone. They meet, this time in Earth's great parable, recast as Anna Andreevna and Salomea, the fruitful soil and the new burgeoning wheat. What would they talk of, those emblems of the age? That is your last surprise. The stove was there, though not a thing to suit the poet's book. Chop fine and marinate, add a pinch of sage. They were women and friends, laughter was in the air. Salomea Nikolaevna, where did you learn to cook? In exile, my dear. one must learn something new. I was not Solominka, no one's muse anymore. So studied the art women have always known. Like them, I have learned to compromise. But you, it was not in your nature. You withdraw, but do not yield, nor fear to stand alone. Forgive me, Amanda, if I have made too free with your enchanting book. In any case, just let me add, as I put by my pen, that thinking of those two, it seems to me that in old age, great women inherit a grace, an afterglow not granted the fates of men. Listen, those laughing voices by the stove, the sorceress from Kiev, the angel bird. It is gossip of women and ordinary mirth. Yet listen, other voices around, above, laugh with them, and beneath them all a third warm, ageless chuckle from the mothering earth. Translation. Secrets of the Craft. 1. Creation. It is like this, a sort of lassitude. Unceasing in my ears a striking clock. Far off a roll of thunder dies away. I seem to hear the groans and mourning of voices imprisoned and unrecognized. The narrowing of a certain secret ring. Yet in this tingling, whispering abyss, one all-subduing sound stands out so clear that round about unbroken stillness reigns, so that one hears the grass grow in the wood. Misery pace earth with his beggar's bag. But now already words are audible and signal chimes of rhymes as light as air. Then I do begin to understand, and simply as they are dictated, lines lie down upon my snow-white writing-pad. 6. Last Poem. One poem, like someone's anxious thunderclap, bursts into my house full of the breath of life, laughs, utters from its throat a tremulous sound, and spins around and claps its hands. The next, out of midnight stillness born, from whence I do not know, steals up on me. As from the empty looking-glass it stares and mutters something stern. But there are some like this. In broad daylight, as though they had not noticed me at all, they stream forth on the paper's white expanse like a pure spring in its ravine. And then again a secret one prowls round. No sound, no colour. Neither hue nor sound it saunters by, changes its shape and struggles, and will not let itself be taken alive. But this one, drop by drop, has drunk my blood, as in my youth a vicious wench, my love, and saying not a single word to me, moved back into the silence once again. Nor have I known more cruel misery than one which went, its track stretched on and on towards some far distant land. Yet without it, I die. 10. There is much, probably, that still desires its celebration by this voice of mine, that which rumbles beyond the reach of words, or underground in darkness grinds on stone, or beats its way along through smoke. I have reckonings not yet resolved with flame and with water and the wind. That is why, for me, my drowsings all of a sudden fling such gates wide open and carry me beyond the morning star. 1. Voronezh. Author's note. In the winter of 1936, Akhmatova paid a visit to the poet Osip Mandelstam and his wife, then living in exile and fear of arrest in the provincial city of Voronezh on the River Don. Voronezh was established as a port and a manufacturing centre by Peter the Great, to whom there is a monument in the city and a fortress which bears his name. The Field of Kulikova refers to the site of an important battle in 1380, in which Prince Dmitry of Moscow defeated the Tatars, whose golden horde at the time dominated the Russian princedoms. The name Voronezh, according to etymology, is probably derived from Voron, raven, but Akhmatova treats it as though from Vorona, crow. End of author's note. Voronezh. And the whole town is cased in ice, as though a village set in glass, with walls, snow, trees. Timidly through the crystal tracts I go, the gay sledge runs with such unsteady ease. Over Crow Town's Peter, crows do fly, and poplars and a vault of clear green sky show pale and muted in the sunlit haze. From slopes of Kulikova's field there strays breath of the mighty, the victorious earth. And overhead the poplars stern clink their glasses suddenly, as if the guests by thousands at this moment stood to drink toasts to our triumph at their wedding feasts. But in the room of the poet in disgrace, his terror and his muse stand watch in turn, and a night comes on to which no dawn gives place. Translation: Lot's wife. And the wife of Lot glanced back behind him and became a pillar of salt. Genesis 19:26. And the just man walked behind the envoy of God, huge and radiant, along the dark hill track. But her anxiety spoke to his wife aloud. It is not yet too late. You could still look back upon your native Sodom and its red towers, the square you sang in, the courtyard where you span, the blank windows of that tall house of yours where you bore children to your beloved man. She looked, and froze in mortal agony. Her eyes were sightless from that instant forth. Her body became transparent salt, and she stood with her swift feet rooted in the earth. Who will mourn for this woman? Who will rue, nor think her the least part of that mischance? My heart at least will not forget her who gave up her life just for a single glance. Translation: The Muse. When at night I await her coming, life, so it seems, hangs on a single thread. What is honour? What is youth? What is freedom, then, in the presence of this dear guest, pipe in hand? And see, she enters, turning back her veil. Taking a long look, she considers me. I say to her, was it you, then, dictated to Dante the pages of hell? She answers, it was I. Translation: Leningrad in March 1941. Author's note: this was shortly before the German invasion of Russia and the 900-day siege of Leningrad. The spires referred to are probably the gilded ones in the Peter and Paul fortress across the Neva from Akhmatova's favourite summer garden. End of author's note. Leningrad in March 1941. The sundial of the Menshikovy Dom. A steamship with its bow wave passing by. Oh, is there anything on earth that I know like that flash of spires reflected from these waves? A slit-like alleyway grows dark. Sparrows perch on the wires overhead. I know by heart every familiar walk. The tang of salt, that too is not so bad. Translation: in memory of my neighbour. Author's note. The child, Valya Smirnov, and his brother were great favourites of Vark Martova before she was evacuated to Tashkent during the siege. She was greatly distressed to hear he had been killed by a bomb splinter during an air raid. End of author's note. In memory of my neighbour, the little Leningrad boy, Valya Smirnov. Knock with your small fist. I will open the door now as I always did. Now I am far beyond a lofty hill, and beyond desert and wind and heat am hid. But never, never will I let you down. I did not hear you groan. You did not come to me and ask for bread. Bring me a sprig of maple leaf instead, or simply several green blades of grass like those you brought to me in springtime last. Bring me, cupped in your little palm, some pure, cool water from our own Neva. And from your little golden head, I shall wash away the trace of blood. A Northern Elegy. Author's note. Akhmatova wrote a number of poems with this title, between 4 and 7, according to various authorities, of which I have translated that on the epochs of memory in this poem. The final section is a translation of her poem on the death of Boris Pasternak. Pushkin's Town and Dostoevsky's Russia. The first Northern Elegy, which has a subtitle Prehistory and bears 2 epigraphs from Pushkin, begins by evoking Leningrad as it was in Dostoevsky's Russia and earlier. Fontany Dom. The old Sheremetev Palace on the Fontanka branch of the Neva, where Akhmatova lodged before the siege and during its early months. The great gates of the palace bore the motto, Deus Conservat Omnia. That elegy, your 4th. In collected works, actually the 6th, according to Amanda Haidt. Your poem without a hero. This long and elaborate creation of the social and intellectual life of the city before the First World War and the subsequent revolution came to her, so Akhmatova said, without premeditation and as though dictated to her. End of author's note. Narrator's note. Sections 2 and 5 are translations. End of narrator's note. A Northern Elegy. Yestre epochi u vospomenanyi. 1. It may be simple to remember all our eyes have seen, much harder to recall what someone else's memory records and make our own eyes resurrect their words. Yet through your poems, which have struck root in me, a city that I have never seen, I see. April. A high, cold sky, intensely blue, ice breaking up, the river breaking through, new energy sweeping out the rubbish of war, the swift, impetuous rush of the Neva, a spring wind bringing the frozen trees to bud, and peace at last, and stirring in the blood of the numbed life left in that shattered town. Carts clearing rubble, sandbags coming down from the bronze horsemen in Decembrist Square, and water rippling, glancing everywhere. The city rising from ruin, your Leningrad. The buildings, yes, but not its million dead in their anonymous graves, packed in and tossed together, unknown, irrecoverable, lost in that great nightmare, the 900 days. Swept to oblivion in so many ways, bombardment, fire, starvation, plague, and cold. But this was not the worst your fears foretold, returning from your exile in Tashkent that June, to see what the long siege had meant. The heaps of rubble where church or palace stood were easier to restore than Valya's blood. The child, your little friend, whose golden head you wrote of in a poem when he was dead. The double task to which you set your mind was to relive lost Leningrad, and behind the city of Peter, Pushkin's town, and Dostoevsky's Russia, and your own. Still proudly standing, your Fontane Dom on the Fontanka met your coming home, with its still prouder motto on the gates, Deus conservat omnia. God creates again where man destroys. Peoples with shades, your summer gardens, leafy walks and glades. No sparrow falls to ground, but he will know. All things that perish remain in him. And so you took your cue from God himself, began your restoration of the world of man. You were the Sibyl with her golden bow, recalling the soul from Lethe's triple slough. You were Eurydice going back to hell. You were Lot's wife, turned back to view the shell of burnt-out Sodom, the ruins where she had sung spinning among her friends when she was young and paid the bitter price without regret. You held it all within you, living yet, as memory raised, like Lazarus from the grave, the flash of spires reflected on the wave. The Menshikov sundial, a passing boat on the Neva, you knew it all by rote. Those two worlds lost by revolution and war were safe. Deus conservat omnia. That was the bitter moment when you wrote that elegy, your fourth from which I quote. 2. There are three periods in recollection. The first, as though it were just yesterday, under that arch of sky, the spirit blessed, the body blissful resting in its shade, its laughter vivid still, its tears unspent. The ink blot from the table not wiped off, as if imprinted on the heart, the kiss, the soul, the parting one, the unforgettable. Yet this endures so little time at all. Already no sky overhead, but in some godforsaken suburb a lone house, cold in the winter, burning hot in summer where there are spiders. Dust lies everywhere, where ardent letters smoulder down to ash, and on the sly the portraits change about, and folk walk there as though towards a grave, and on returning wash their hands with soap and brush away a glancing little tear from weary eyelids. Heave a heavy sigh. But clocks tick on, and spring replaces spring, one after one, and still the sky turns pink. The names of towns and cities are replaced. Witnesses to events are found no more, and none with whom to weep or to remember. And slowly from our presence shades depart whom we have ceased already to invoke, and whose return we would find terrible. Once, as we wake, we see we have forgotten even the way there to that lonely house, so that choking with shame and rage we run to find it. But as happens in a dream, all there is different. People, objects, walls, and no one knows us. We are strangers there. We have come to the wrong number. Oh, my God! And then, when comes the bitterest of all, we have to own we could not find a place within life's present boundaries for that past, to us as alien now or nearly so as to our neighbour in the flat next door, that we would not have recognised the dead, that those whom God has put apart from us got on quite well without us, and that even all has been for the best. 3. A bitter moment. Yet what seemed to be dissolved in loss and mutability led on to a new epoch nonetheless. For memory, though then you could not guess, must first dislimb, transform, be torn apart before its resurrection into art presents the spirit in that new flesh reborn. Those personal memories must be withdrawn. Like autumn leaves, must strip your branches bare, flutter to the damp soil and moulder there. and only when dispersed beyond recall by private wish or conscious will at all comes the fourth epoch, in which poetry grows from that humus like a magic tree. Memory is the seed, and that is why, unless it fall into the ground and die, it cannot create the new life of the corn. So, sitting as you thought, deprived, forlorn, amid the ruins of your ambitious plan, suddenly in the night it all began. Your poem without a hero, stage by stage, laid down its lines unbidden on the page, and unpremeditated, unforeseen, your world up to the fatal year 13, a world transfigured, risen from the dead, emerged through you as though without your aid. And all those voices, silent now so long, came at your call, but spoke in their own tongue. Yet in that miracle of spontaneous art, you saw, although you seemed to take no part, that fourth epoch of memory breaking through had been there all the time, unknown to you. You saw beyond the poet's utmost skill, forces subsume her individual will. Her personal gifts, surrendered willingly, she speaks at last for all humanity. For stones and trees, for water and for fire, the dumb creation and the world entire. 4. Yet poets who translate all to speech must learn to be themselves translated in their turn and pass into the general life of things, which, having been granted utterance, now sings the timeless poet to repay that debt. And the dead mouths find life and utterance yet. The fifth and final stage of memory comes when the poet is laid in earth, and she no more remembers for her age. But now all things remember her. As where the plough once cut deep into fallow, an ancient field at sunset from the air may be revealed. Paths trodden by long dead feet, and a faint plan of towns and farmsteads of archaic man. So from the poet's lines, by time's decay, the trivial and the temporary leached away, the bones and the bare outlines left behind restore the permanent colloquy of mankind. The poet takes her place beneath its sod in the unfailing providence of God, as what was personal in her shares in his sustaining and abiding synthesis, and the whole universe plays that music back, as you yourself wrote of dead Pasternak. 5. The unique voice fell silent. Yesterday the interlocutor of the grove has left us, say rather to the life-giving ear of grain transformed, or what he sang, the gentle rain. And every flower to which the world gives birth has bloomed to meet this death. And suddenly there is silence on this planet, on which we confer the unassuming name of Earth. For a grave at Komarova. Author's note. Akhmatova is buried in the cemetery at Komarova, near Leningrad. End of author's note. For a grave at Komarova. Ye gavorye, ti idanti diktovala stranitsi ada, odvichayet, ya. When you emerged at last on this dark shore, and at long last the stars shone overhead and their peace filtered down and promised rest, was she not there to meet you as before, when life, it seemed, hung on a single thread, your steadfast visitant, your midnight guest? Did she not hold you with her tranquil gaze, take back the ring she gave and break the spell, touching with her light flute your lips and brow? Was it you, then, with Dante trod the maze of the interminable gyres of hell, which, each alive, it was your fate to know? And did the muse not smile at your reply? Sister, I went alone, but it was I. This is the end of Antechinus, Poems, 1975 to 1980 by A.D. Hope. Your narrator has been Brian Harrison, with production assistance from Joanne Carroll. Following is a biographical note about the author and a list of his other books. A.D. Hope was born in 1907 at Cooma, New South Wales. He was educated at Bathurst High School and Fort Street High School, Sydney, and at the universities of Sydney and Oxford. He became a teacher and vocational psychologist, lectured in English at Sydney Teachers College and Melbourne University, and subsequently was appointed Professor of English at the Australian National University, Canberra, at which institution he later became Emeritus Professor and Library Fellow. Over the years, he has won numerous literary awards, the most recent being the Age Book of the Year Award 1976 and the Robert Frost Award 1976. In 1981, he was made a Companion of the Order of Australia in recognition of his outstanding contribution to Australian literature. Also by A.D. Hope, poetry, The Wandering Islands, poems, selected poems, collected poems, new poems, A Late Picking, The Drifting Continent, A Book of Answers, Dunciad Minor. Criticism, The Cave and the Spring, Native Companions, The Pack of Autolycus, A Midsummer Eve's Dream, The New Critillus.
Production and copyright announcement. This Daisy book was created by the Vision Australia Information Library Service in 2006. This recording is copyright. No unauthorised copying, broadcasting or public performance is permitted. This concludes the recording.